We're going to go ahead and get started so that I can just be 2 minutes late this time. My name is Ty Fisher, and you're in the workshop called something like Preparing or Transitioning into the Logic Years. If that's the workshop that you mean to be in, you're in the right place. If not, I take no offense at your leaving now. But later, probably. Okay. I'm sure there's an outline for it. Is that it? Before we get started, let's pray and ask God's blessing. Heavenly Father, we thank you that children grow. We thank you that you made the world to grow. We thank you that your life is both pictured in the natural world and in the resurrection, where life overflows and overcomes death. So we pray, Father, today that you would help us to learn about our children and to learn about ourselves, to become better instructors and guides for our children and students. In Jesus' name, amen. Change is a word in vogue today. Change is usually both enlivening and messy. It seems that change comes to everything. Some changes are generally viewed as negative, such as illness, loss of job, failure of a PowerPoint projector in your teaching lesson. Some changes are caused by sin, broken trust, death, even divorce. Some changes we look forward to, such as a wedding, birth of a child, or a new job. We have to admit, however, that negative and even sinful changes do present extraordinary opportunities for growth and development. Losing a job can be an impetus to finding a new and better one. A failure in teaching a lesson can lead us to discover how to be a better teacher. As Christians, even death comes with the hope of the resurrection. And grief for the dying comes with our trust that our pain, though real, is meaningful and will one day be swallowed up in joy. Change, even hard change, opens possibilities. While negative changes might not be as bad as they initially look, when we consider good changes, we must see that they have a complexity and trouble to them. While the blessings of being a newlywed are great, problems often come up. And that brings me to what my wife and I affectionately call the great trash bag debacle. Okay, it happened very early in our married life, and it had to do with two very competitive people, my wife and I. Now, we married, and this would be my advice to any of you who are not married. You guys down here in the front, maybe you're not married. Find someone who you can have a really good fight with, okay? Someone who's competitive enough to be a challenge to you. The first date that my wife and I went on, she beat me in horse, okay? I'm from Indiana. That's not funny. I'm not sure why you're laughing, okay? Now, okay, you know, so you laugh at me. I see you. She hit 20 consecutive shots, free throw line and better. Golly, I couldn't call home until I beat her the next time. But then we came to playing foosball, and our hands were wrapped in bandages for days after that. But then came the great trash bag debacle. It was our first real fight. And what it had to do with was how you tied a trash bag, the proper way to tie a trash bag. Now, I grew up, and we'll call the line of tradition that I grew up in, the twist tie tradition, okay? It's based on a couple of presuppositions. The presuppositions are, number one, everything that they give you in the box of hefty wisdom is useful. Thus, if they give you twist ties are to be used, not to be stored for future generations. Okay, so what I would do when the trash was full is I would take the bag, I would hold it up like so, I would spin it with great vigor. This was the fun part. And I would grab it and I would twist tie it. This worked very well, except when the bag was extremely full. Then you had problems because you couldn't really get a good tie at the top. My wife, however, came up from the crossover tradition, where you take the edges of the bag and you tie them together. You do this twice. I hear, is that clapping? Okay. We have some of these schools of thought represented here with us. Okay. Well, this was all fine and well that we didn't know that there was this great division, this great gulf fixed between us, until the first time we had to take the trash out. And I picked it up and was doing this spinny thing, and she began to shake her head. What had she done? She hadn't looked deeply enough into the life of the man that she married. Little did she know I was from the twist tie school. She said, that's not the right way to do it. To which I said, there is a right way to do it. She showed me her way, seemingly senseless, but it did explain to me this strange fact that I had noticed at her parents' house, which is one cupboard that they have is full of hundreds of thousands of twist ties. Saved, we can only imagine, for future generations where they will learn cold fusion and use twist ties to somehow produce all the energy of the world. I said, honey, I like my way. Well, as you can see, a great fight construed from that. Misunderstandings were given. Suppositions made like there is no right way. Yes, there is. It went back and forth. And eventually I learned the right way to tie a trash bag. You take the corners and you tie it. And I found that there are some parts of life that are better, that your wife is smarter about, or even if she's not smarter, you should just give way. And I tie my trash bags like that religiously, and we have piles of twist ties if you ever need any. Okay? Change comes. That change, I think, in the end, ended up being a positive one for me. I've switched sides. If you have a child that's moving through the grammar school, or maybe even cruising through the grammar school, things might seem easy now, but let me tell you, change is coming. Remember, you teach your kids grammar school methods like, just take the question and you can turn it into the answer. Okay? Boy, when they understand that, tests get really easy, right? I remember that one part, and I can make the rest of the sentence up. Never miss the complete sentence ever again. Change is coming, though. Teaching your child is going to change. Or if it doesn't, you're going to be sorry. If, however, you prepare yourself and your child or student for this change, you can better manage this transition that it will inevitably come whether you want it or not. And perhaps you can even start to enjoy it. So that's my goal for this workshop, to talk with you about how that transition can happen and how hopefully you can make it enjoyable. And at the end, we will go over trash bag etiquette. Okay, today what I'm going to talk to you about is what you are asking needs to change, what you are asking of them needs to change, and then finally, what you're expecting needs to change. And then I'll deal with a couple of objections that people might have. Okay, first thing is, what you are asking needs to change. The first thing we have to realize is there's just a difference between the grammar years and the logic years. In grammar school, of course, we focus on those basic things like who, what, where, when. Okay? These things are enjoyable for them to learn. They chant them. They sing them. They sing them so much that it is great. If you have younger kids, let me recommend a rule for you that we have at my house. No individualized singing at the table. Okay? Because corporate singing, great at the table. Four girls singing different things at once, bad. It is bad. Okay, but they love singing about all kinds of those different things that they're learning. Now, we move into the logic stage. At Veritas Academy, we call this 7th through 9th, but the truth of the matter is the logic stage does not magically begin when they start 7th grade, nor does it magically end at 7th grade. Some of you who are in a homeschooling situation might say something like, it's 5th grade and it's already the logic stage, okay? Or you might say, it's 9th grade and they're still kind of like grammar,
okay? You don't stop learning grammar in the logic when you start focusing on logic, but they do go on to and focus on other things. The logic years are really about interrelationships and logical connections. Instead of asking who, what, where, and when, you're now asking why and how. As your students near the end of the grammar school, particularly in sixth grade, make sure that you are stretching them to deeper levels of comprehension. Okay? Your literature class needs, or your history class needs to start having more of that discussion time element in it. As they grow and mature, you need to grow and mature in the way that you teach them. If you have memory period, did any of you do memory period? We do, okay. We do memory period at Veritas Academy. They sing, they chant, they do everything. When they get to sixth grade, however, this year we started a new process of what we call graduating from memory period. What this means is you do really well in memory period in the first half of the year, and you graduate out of it. You add up your points, and you go on to do something else. You're still learning that grammar, but you're learning it a different way, because memory period, singing all those little songs with second graders, becomes less than cool for the sixth grader. Okay? Listen, it's amazing how kids can misunderstand things as you move into the logic age. I will give you an example from my own family. We lived out in the woods. We lived so far out in the woods that my friends couldn't even find their way back from my house. And we didn't do a lot of hunting, but hunters would come out and hunt on our land once. And my brother, Andy, he's a great guy. He was in the logic stage at this point. He saw the hunters walking around, and he asked my father a question as we were driving around in the truck. He said, "Why do they wear that orange color?" My father, you know, we've lived out in the woods all of our lives. We should know these kinds of things. He says, "Andy, I cannot believe that you don't know why hunters wear orange." And my brother, trying to cover, said something like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They have to give the rabbits a fair chance." My dad was, "What? What are you talking about?" He just hadn't put the facts together. So my brother was like, "Oh, yeah, 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 I forever remember. Rabbits can't see orange." Okay? Kids misunderstand things. Okay? And that, as you're moving into that logic stage, be ready for those kinds of misunderstandings, that kind of messiness, especially with boys. Finally, think about this in things, what you're asking needs to change. You need to have well-planned transition at this point. If you can do this in that fifth and sixth grade time frame, you're going to really prepare them well for what you're going to ask of them and what you're going to start grading from them when they get into seventh grade. At Veritas, we're still learning how to do this really well. I'm going to give you some examples later on, but the more you think carefully about this with fifth and sixth grade students or children, the better off they're going to be as they move into the logic stage. Okay, the second big point is what you're asking of them needs to change. First thing is you need to start asking them to take a side, okay, of an argument. Give them a question and make them take a side. This is very difficult for students initially. They want to parrot back right information. They think taking an opinion is getting an encyclopedia and copying down what's inside. That's not an argument, okay? Initially, they are very uncomfortable. And I have a couple of rules about this. The first one is ban all political speech from your school, okay? And by political speech, if you ever listen to the greatest example of this kind of question answering was the debates between Al Gore and George W. Bush back in that presidential election. I don't know if you remember it, but I think some of you will remember when I mentioned a couple of phrases. Their handlers gave them answers and then told them basically to ignore questions, right? Just give the answer. This happened in the most recent debate
as well, I think, on the vice presidential debate, there was a striking emphasis of this with Palin once, where someone asked a question about something, and she said, but I'd really like to talk about energy. Okay? Gore's famous line was, the lockbox, remember? So they'd ask him a question about foreign policy, and he would say, Social Security money needs to be put into a lockbox. Okay? At Veritas, we have this rule that says, it's the first rule of our secondary school, answer the question. Okay? When I ask you a question, answer it. Don't tell me a list of true things. Okay? I know that you know true things. Believe me. We've been teaching you all those true things. Now I'm asking you to answer the question. The second rule, well, this is actually the fourth rule that we have at Veritas, is I am me. Okay? Students, when students feel uncomfortable taking a side, you will always get this, I believe this, or I think this. Just tell them, start striking that. If you say it, I'm going to trust that you believe it. Okay? You are you. You don't need to tell me you believe it. If you say it, I'm going to take, you know, I don't think you're lying to me. I'm going to take it at face value. Get them to take a side. You never have to do this in a lower grammar school. I mean, this is a transitional skill that they'll need. Begin by asking them leading questions, okay? But when you want answers, never give them answers. Never, ever, 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 ever give them answers. If they can't come up with the answer, give them another question, an easier question, a more leading question, okay? But make them get used to answering questions. We have a lot of fun with this at Veritas. Some students have accused me of never, ever giving an answer. And this hurts kids sometimes at the beginning. It's strange. They're pregnant pauses. It's like a puppy who's learned to fetch the paper, and then there's no paper anymore. You know, they're like, what am I supposed to do? You know, aren't you going to tell me the answer so that I can say the answer back? But get them used to that Socratic method of, give me the answer. What do you think? You need to start thinking now. So get them to take a side. The next thing you need to ask of them is getting them to defend their thinking. This is the nasty question that you have to start asking them. You know, so they'll stand up and they'll give. Finally, you'll get them to take a side, and you'll say, "Why do you think that?" Okay. This is always nifty, because what you'll have sometimes is some students you'll really have a struggle getting them to take a side. Then once they learn how to do that, you'll have some students that will confuse assertion with argument. Okay? The most hilarious instance of this that I had back in my early days at Veritas was a young lad who, as we were reading about the French Revolution, he raised his hand, and for shock value, he said, people really have they have sensory abilities for 10 seconds after they've been guillotined. You know, their heads are still alive. I don't know if that's true or false. You know, I have no idea. He was basically saying it to shock the girls in class. Okay, he wanted people to have nightmares. So I looked at him and I was like, how do you know? I mean, did you do any experiments on this? And he hunkered down. You know, did you kill people to figure this out? I mean, where did you read about this? The answer was, I didn't, but I asserted it, so it must be true, right? It's amazing how many old wives' tales and things come out in these kind of vast assertions. So keep asking them this question. I'll give you another example of when this kind of comes in helpful. And I'll make a recommendation here. It might be in the reading list on the back. It's not. You can add this book. It is David Hicks's book, Norms and Nobility. Okay, and he talks about the concept of pre-discussion there. And basically, pre-discussion is a neat little chapter or a neat little concept that he talks about. He had a teacher that just loved the Socratic dialogues. But the way he wanted to help his students love them was he had them take home a Socratic dialogue and outline it. Okay? Oh, my.
oh my, this will not foster love. And he came back the next day and the students hated Plato. The same thing happened to me. Okay, I started a class on Socrates. We read a little bit. And I remember one student kind of looked down and muttered, just stupid, 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 he said. I was like, this is not good. We are on chapter one. There are 15 chapters left. What am I going to do? So I just said, put your books away. We're going to start thinking. So I pointed out the window and I pointed a tree and I said, what is that tree? Or is there a tree there? Or is there not? After a couple of days of sitting there and thinking about tree-ness, I had turned five people that thought Socrates was stupid into five committed Platonists who didn't really believe there was a tree in the courtyard. At that point, you need to work back. You need to work back toward some good reality therapy at that point. But keep asking that question. Get them to start defending. Why do you think that? Why do you think it's stupid? You know, sometimes students say things like that for shock value, and sometimes you can just say, so why do you think that? It's disarming sometimes. The next thing that you need to, what you are asking of them needs to change. The third thing that you need to think about there is getting them used to attacking forcefully and properly. Okay? You have two opportunities here. Number one, you get to instruct them how to argue forcefully. What you do not want, listen, you've got to, and especially you ladies, because you're nicer people, okay? You do not want them to stumble out into the world without being ready to stand up and fight, to draw a line and to stand on it and to say, I'm going to defend this position, okay? It might seem messy when you're trying to teach them to argue forcefully, but you want them to be able to do that. The other side of it is you have a chance to train them to argue respectfully. And in the end, while at the beginning these two things might seem divergent, okay, in the end the strongest arguments have that kind of respectful appropriateness behind them, okay? But you have to train them in both. Now I'm going to give you a warning here. Do not turn argumentative sections of your teaching into an etiquette class, okay? This will be a temptation because you don't want the Jerry Springer show at your homeschool or study center. You don't want that to break out. So your one temptation is, let's make this into an etiquette class. It's the etiquette of argument. Here's what I would say this. Punish malice, but correct over-exuberance lightly in the beginning. If you don't, you might get the opposite of over-exuberance, which is under exuberance, which is boring. Eventually, if you work this well, eventually you will not have to encourage them to argue. I will give you two, four instances that happened that are heartwarming to me. I spent most of the stuff that you see in the omnibus books that I developed. Comes out of my work with five students at Veritas Academy. I had the same five students for 4 years in an omnibus class. And they got so used to me walking to the board and writing a question on the board that they would start answering the question while I was writing it. Okay? They would also criticize my spelling, my handwriting. By the time I turned around, there was a full-blown argument going. Sometimes that had nothing to do with what I would start, like, what is love? And, you know, things would happen. The argument was ready to go. So eventually they will be trained to love, I hope, love argument, and you'll have to kind of rein them in. The funnest thing that happened, though, is these five students are still pretty close. I mean, they keep in contact through the invisible world of the internet a lot. And they're doing great stuff. One of them is married. So what he had the smart idea. He said, what I'd really like to do with my fiance is I'd like to bring her back and introduce her to the other five. And Mr. Fisher can come to dinner and Mr. Dawson, my other omnibus teacher, he can come to dinner. Well, this young man, his job is now, he's an officer in training to be on a nuclear submarine. So whenever we would get to like just war theory, I would spend all this time talking about the ethics of nuclear warfare. Because no one really wants to be the teacher of the guy that pressed the button. Okay? So we would just hunker down on that. And we'd debate it, we'd think about it, we'd argue about it. We'd throw things. One time there was a student hiding under the desk because it was just a war going on. If we would have had nuclear weapons in class, it would have been over. And he brought this young lady back, and everybody sat down around the table, and we were all quiet and kind and very respectful of her. And then somebody, and I'm not sure who it was, said, "Did you see that they ran a nuclear test in North Korea?" And when that happened, all of the old discussion tension, this dam broke, and the fight, I mean, people were throwing potatoes at each, I mean, it wasn't that bad, but I'm just saying, you know, this is, you know, you've got to think this way about it. We go back in this old argument. And then I look over to the side, and here's this young lady kind of, you know, backing away from the table. I'm like, no, we're not really all like this. It's just this thing we talk about. But that kind of argument, that kind of love of discussing those kind of issues is what you want to see with the kids. So don't turn your class into an exercise in etiquette, especially initially. Here's some of the things that I do as I'm trying to get them to attack forcefully. Sometimes I will intentionally throw out bad thinking and see what they'll do with it. I will give them the wrong answer to the question, okay? And see if they're able to go, "Hey, Mr. Fisher, do you understand the implications of what you're talking about here?" You know, if they can do that. The best essay that I've ever received as a teacher began with this sentence. It was a question that I had the students writing on Candide, and it was a long sentence, so it's not very good grammatically, but the student said, I asked the question, the student said, "Mr. Fisher thinks the answer to this question is, but he is wrong." And I remember I got to that point in the essay, and I said, "Oh, well," I grabbed my big red pen. I buy $30 worth of red pens at the beginning of the year, and I like to try to use them all. So I got my big red pen, I took the cap off of it, I put it behind my ear, and I said, okay, let's go to town. And by the end of it, he was right. I was wrong. Remember, it's okay to learn things from your students. It's not against the rule, and if you praise them for that, they'll go at it even harder. Remember, this is another thing that's tough for some students, especially students who transition out of the grammar stage a little bit later. As you're asking them to attack more forcefully, some of them are still kind of grammar stage students, and sometimes they will shine a little more or a little less during this new stage. Sometimes you get to pat people on the back that you didn't get to pat on the back before. That's really great. Sometimes the student who's used to making straight A's is struggling, you know, to make A's and B's. And that's really frustrating. So make sure that you're patting on the back and encouraging people along as they move through this transition. Finally, under this point, remember that boys and girls are different. Okay? This, by the way, what I just said is a heretical thought in our culture. In fact, it's a heretical thought that is kind of coming back into vogue, though. One of the public schools in Lancaster County is considering having single-sex classes at some point, which I think is probably a pretty good idea for their school. The interesting thing was, in the paper, you know, it's this big, long article, with all of this scientific justification based on brainwave analysis and, you know, all these psych tests that they've given people to tell us that girls are too cowardly to answer simple questions in a science class when surrounded by boisterous boys. you didn't really need that analysis, did you? Anybody that's married knows this. I mean, it's generally true that boys and girls are different. If you don't buy this, or maybe you haven't been around the other gender, I will tell you how they are different. Boys are hardwired to attack. You need to guide this, but do not squelch their bravado, okay? Because one day they're going to, if you're lucky, one day they're going to learn how to attack the things you want them to attack. This is my nasty great fear, one of them going on right now, and that is, if King David were alive today, we'd have him on Ritalin. Okay? We'd say, because when he showed up at the battle, his older brothers said basically, "You nosy little whippersnapper, why do you always come into things and make a mess?" And the Bible doesn't say that the brothers were wrong. It just kind of goes on, and David says, "See that big guy over there? I got him. You guys pick out other people. I got the big guy." And I can just see, as an older brother, I'm like, "Oh man, that boy needs a little beat down right there." But that boy was after God's own heart. Okay, boys are like that. Girls, what I found with girls at this age is girls are driven to get things correct and right. Okay, they're kind of where boys are driven to see how big a thing they can knock over. Girls are driven to see how correctly, precisely, maturely they can do things. They really want to be thought of as adult. You need to help your girls understand this too, that when we get to arguing and debating with each other, I try to help my girls understand the beauty and terror of strong biblical femininity. If they play their cards right in an argument, they are at a massive advantage over and against their male counterparts. Because they can very, very, I tell them this, stand up, dress appropriately. Number one, keep your ethos intact. Stand up, smile, speak clearly and directly. Attack, but don't attack viciously. But here are the rules. You can punch him, and he can't punch you. This is the basic rule of argument. Any young man that stands up and like thrashes at a young lady, you're destroying your ethos. Girls who can make strong biblical arguments, I just pat the guy on the back and say, "You're basically done." It's very difficult to get past that. These guys are laughing down here. They think it's probably happened to you, hasn't it? No comment. Okay, that means yes. Okay, the next big point I want to talk about is what you're expecting needs to change. First, you need to prepare yourself for the mess. At the beginning, you must take them by the hand and lead them through arguments. I usually use eating analogies, but with grammar school, this is the eating analogy you need to think of. It's like feeding your little child those terrible mashed things that they put in those little cans, you know, those glass jars that you unscrew. And have you ever tasted that stuff? It's horrible. But what you do is you stick the spoon in for the child. You don't give the child the spoon. As a young father, you make that disastrous choice once, okay, and then you clean the walls. You stick the spoon in there. You take the spoon. You hold it out. Generally, you have to open your mouth for them to get the hint. You stick it in, they close their mouth, you pull it out, and you repeat. This is what grammar school is. Grammar school is you spooning knowledge into their mind. The logic years are not like this. You have to give them the spoon. Okay? This is what makes you are bringing on the mess by giving them the spoon. Do not discourage them too much if they jump in exuberantly, but sometimes their answers aren't going to make that much sense.
Okay? I had a teacher in high school that did a great job of this. He would ask a question, and this was in the same age, 7th or 8th grade. He would ask a question, and I mean, it wasn't this bad, but this was how he would have handled it. He would say, "What is 2 plus 2? You know, some kid would have gone, 7. And he would have gone, "That is a great answer. Super. Does anyone have another answer?" Okay? You need to, sometimes they'll be trying to do the things they need to do, and man, they veer off into the woods. Still be encouraging of them to jump in there and be exuberant. The second thing you need to do, what you are expecting needs to change, you need to prepare yourself for the challenge. They will challenge you, but only if you teach them to, and you enable and allow them to. And you should do that, okay? It's sometimes hard to have them challenge your thinking. And make sure that you draw this line, okay? And in that line, they can have a chance to challenge your thinking without them being disrespectful to you, okay? Because let me tell you, what you want in the end is you want them to take that thinking as their own, okay? And if they don't have a chance to challenge you, if they don't have a chance to, we have a school made up of generally Protestant Christians, and Protestant Christians agree about a lot of stuff. They don't necessarily agree about everything. One of the things, baptism is the sacrament given to unite the church that we constantly disagree about, okay, that constantly divides us. Okay, so one year I was blessed enough to have 12 students, 6 of them from a Paedo Baptist families, and 6 of them from Believers Baptist backgrounds. And we had a big debate, but I forced them to argue for the other side. So they had to learn the other side of the argument. Their parents trusted me enough at that point to know that I wasn't trying to lead them off the path that their parents had for them. I was trying to get them to grasp that path. Okay? That's what you want in the end. You don't want them to go off outside of your house or out into the great big world without ever having taken those ideas and see if they really work, see if they really want to grab hold of them. You shouldn't encourage them to be rebellious, but you need to help them to love Christ and love truth volitionally, not just because you told them to. Note this also. Some will be so black and white that they will hurt you. So prepare yourself. Prepare yourself for that. And then finally, I told you to prepare yourself for the mess, but then I want to tell you, prepare yourself for the mess and prepare yourself for the challenge. But finally, you need to prepare yourself for the reward. If you train them in this version of mental self-defense, you can look forward to the day when they will stand beside you in the fray. Okay? This, I think, is mainly the meaning of the end of Psalm 127, where it says, as arrows are in the hands of a mighty man, so are the children of one's youth. This man will stand in the gate and speak with his enemies. That last phrase is kind of, you know, you scratch your head about it a little bit. He stands and speaks with his enemies because he's surrounded by these arrows, okay? To translate into kind of modern urban parlance, he's surrounded by an awesome posse, okay? He's got his boys, like oak trees, standing around you, okay? That's what you can look forward to if they follow through this path and you train them to defend themselves. They might even be able to lead you and to lead others. Tom Garfield, the headmaster at the Logos School in Moscow, Idaho, tells a great story about this, especially as it relates to boys. And let me just tell you, boys take more faith than girls do.
This is the kind of point of the story. He was had a faculty meeting with his teachers, and he said something like this. He said, think about our girls that are seniors. You know, they will go on to college, and they will get married, and some of them, you know, are going to be getting married very soon. And he said, you know, in 6 or 7 years, these girls might be moms bringing children to kindergarten here at Logos. And he said the faculty was, you know, they were smiling, you know, kind of looking off like, oh, won't that be wonderful to have them back? And then he said, and the boys. These boys who are going out now, they're going to be taking jobs, they're going to be going to college, they're going to be getting married, they're going to be having children. In 5 or 6 years, these boys are going to be back here as fathers at Logos School. And he said there was general panic in the room. Like, no, you know, it can't be. They're not allowed to do that, are they? Remember, boys take a little bit more faith, but God makes them able to lead and able to tear down strongholds. So have faith, even when it's messy. There are some objections to transitioning kids, and I call them by names that show you that I don't like a lot of them. But here they are. You can see them from my skewed perspective. First one is the pillow fallacy. Call it the pillow fallacy. You can also call it the catechetical fallacy. The fallacy goes something like this. But they have to know the truth. They have to know it. So what I'm going to just do is I'm going to never let them go 1 second down the wrong path. Okay, I'm always just going to give them the catechism answer over and over again. You know, that's, and then they'll have truth. Okay, I understand a desire for that, but where's it going to? If you don't train them by actually training them, you might have some problems. Okay, I'll put it this way: homeschooling when they're 18, great. Homeschooling when they're 40, pricey. Okay? When they're still not ready, when they're still not ready to get out there into the fray, you've got a problem. Make sure that your education is enabling them to get out there into the fight, not debilitating them, keeping them from the fight. Okay? Second part of the pillow fallacy here is usually this is a parental problem more than a student problem. It has a lot more to do with people not wanting folks to know that your child does not know everything immediately. Remember, kids are not just parlor tricks. That's not all they do. Really, this kind of fallacy, this kind of fallacious thinking is an issue of pride and not an issue of the kid's pride usually. Okay, the next fallacy I call the laminator fallacy. It's the fallacy that what we really need to do, you know what a laminator is, okay? Anybody that works in grammar school, they love the laminator. I don't let my secondary teachers touch the laminator because they harm it. The laminator, it puts that thin sheet of protective plastic on both sides of a piece of paper so that it becomes eternal, okay? But secondary teachers, and all my secondary teachers are male right now, secondary teachers, they're flummoxed by the laminator. You know, they can't work it correctly. They burn their hands. They leave it on so that you can turn these big rolls of this super plastic, you can turn them into one blob. Okay? We've done all this stuff. So they're not allowed to touch it. They have to hand it off to qualified people. But the laminator fallacy says, I'm going to protect them by not allowing them any exposure to any ideas of consequence other than biblical ones. I have to deal with this from families a lot of times because I'll just let you in on a little hint. If you do like the laminator fallacy, you probably should take that omnibus book back to the Veritas Press booth and see if you can get your money back.
because that really isn't what I'm after in the Omnibus series. Maybe the question to ask as evangelical Christians is the Dr. Phil question. How's this one working out for us? You know, have we really been able to successfully laminate our kids against culture? Rhetorical answer, no. It hasn't worked well. This is why so many kids, Christian kids, take their faith to college and punt it whenever they're confronted by thinking unbelief. Okay? And they will be confronted by thinking unbelief. And what are they going to do? Listen, I went my first year and a half before I transferred to Grove City, I went to the University of Southern Indiana, in Evansville, Indiana, in the Bible Belt, in the Midwest. My ethics teacher, we talked about different ethical issues. He did not believe in abortion rights. He believed in infanticide. He said, children aren't people until they have a personality. They don't have a personality until they're three, he said, two or three. He wasn't married. He didn't have children, which was a blessing. Don't think. And you know what? Most of the class was just cowered from him. Not because they didn't, not because their parents didn't teach them to believe the Bible, just because they weren't ready. They weren't ready to take on thinking, articulate unbelief. The next worst outcome for the laminator fallacy is success, because it produces Christians that are impotent and unable to really interact with or take dominion in culture. So the laminator works, but instead of keeping the bad stuff out, it keeps the good stuff in. It ends up being the plastic trap. The next fallacy I call the ostrich fallacy. It's the fallacy that says, I can stick my head in the sand and this will just happen anyway. Isn't this kind of natural, right? Note this, students learn from their teachers, and you will teach them well or you will teach them poorly, and they will suffer if you teach them badly at this point. It will their minds grow? Yes. If their teacher doesn't transition them well, will it hurt them? Yeah, it will. The final one, and this is my least favorite one maybe, is what I call the niceness fallacy. And it's this, my children cannot do this, so I'm simply going to focus on them doing the things that they can do. Okay? It has this air of kind of helpfulness or kindness to it, but in the end it ends up being cruel. Because it's preparing them to be at the mercy of other people. It's training them to go into the battle that they have to go into without armor. So don't do that. Don't think that we're just going to make nice little kids. Hasn't worked out well. Well, you can prepare your children by forming questions carefully, by forcing them to make judgments, and by encouraging them to think even when it's messy. I pray it's not this kind of process is one where I can give you hints of some of the things that we did, but it's especially in a homeschool setting or in a co-op setting, in a study center setting, you have to kind of work, you have to work with the students that are in front of you to lead them through this process. But I think that the principles that you see in this kind of a lecture will help you in that process. Do we have any questions as we wind this up? No questions. Yes, sir. Okay. You will like them less. what I would say is there are a few that I like to use that they're not really that good. They don't work all of the time. But anytime a boy tries to part his hair, okay, he's starting to become cognizant of the world outside of him. He's starting to become pert and dialectic, okay? I would also say that boys are always more external. They're easier to see in this. But anytime you see that young man
think of a kind of a respectful young man, and you might feel him kind of questioning things more or kind of chomping at the bit more. He might even get in trouble a little bit more. And that's really a shift in his thinking. A lot of times generally will kind of walk on the line that you give them. I've found that most boys kind of try to get out there, more than girls anyway, they try to test the limits a little bit more. And you kind of have to tap them back into line. I would also say this. Maybe this is a better test for girls than boys, because I've not really found boys to be immensely successful at this at any point until they get into later high school, when they're obviously past the logic stage. And that is, when girls can understand and enjoy Jane Austen, they're starting to move into the logic years. Because Austen, unlike Dickens, reading Dickens is like playing cards with someone who holds their cards out in front of you. It's not fun. Okay, I'm not a Dickens fan. But Austen doesn't tell you anything. Okay, she just gives you the scantest. To read Austen, you have to understand insinuation and implication. And you have to like look at these hints and know what's happening that she's not telling you about. So if you ever want to do a great, really fun experiment, get, you know, Pride and Prejudice and get, you know, five boys and five girls, eighth graders, and have them read a couple pages. And then just put the book down and then say, now what just happened? And it was a hilarious thing. I said this, and the six girls, their hands shoot up. They're going to faint. They're going to get carpal tunnel. Okay? And I remember looking over at one guy. He was like, and then I called on this young lady. She's now, at Penn State, and she's working with one of the Milton scholars there. And she just kind of erupts. And I remember this, the boy is over there, and he's looking just incredulously, like, and then he picks up the book, and he looks at it. It's kind of like it's you know, like it's a spell book, and he opens up and starts. He just kind of tosses it down. But when girls, that's a little telltale sign of girls starting to put those things off the screen, you know, off of the just thing that's right in front of them. When they start to put that together, that's a sign that their mind is kind of growing into that ability to do things like implication and read insinuations and things like that. Right. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, it has. It's not, you know, we're a fairly old-fashioned kind of institution, and I think that I'm kind of a fan of that old-fashionedness. I think that I describe my job as getting the right people, the right teachers, in a room with the right students, and then just basically closing the door, giving the teacher some instructions, closing the door and waiting for 6 or 8 years or something like that, and then opening the door and going, look what happened. Those lives pressed together in community really form each other. That said, we didn't have to worry about downloadable papers and text messages under the table and stuff like that. I'm a little bit different. I might change on this. We don't restrict our kids from bringing some technologies to school. We demand that they use them maturely when they're at school. So, for instance, they can call their parents on their cell phone over lunch. Okay, if you want to call them, you can call them. But I don't want you cutting yourself off from the group. If I see you just kind of hanging out somewhere chatting on the cell phone all the time, I'll just tell you can't have it anymore. you need to use technology maturely. The stuff that Graham does on PowerPoint, if you saw that, that would have been impossible, you know, a couple of years ago. Or would have been impossible. It still might be impossible for me. But that kind of stuff, I think that you've got to be... You've got to be guarded in a way that says what you don't want is, I believe that technology can be an aid, but often becomes a crutch that is harmful rather than helpful. You know what? You can do your research paper lickety split with 86 internet sources of, and maybe, you know, 20 of them are valid. I mean, you know, 20 of them are not just Jimmy over in his garage typing out his opinion here on his blog. I think you've got to be more guarded. The other thing that I think is an interesting question is, how much white noise does this bring into our lives? If you get Mars Hill Audio, this last quarterly version, there are a couple of interviews on it that really talk about the danger that this massive relational technology that we have now turns kids inward in a way that the most meaningful things become things that in the whole scope of life are horrifically trivial. But they spend all of their time worrying about their Facebook page, or I forget who it was. I forget the speaker, but he said, why could anything that happened on Omaha Beach 60 years ago mean anything to me? You know, what I'm more worried about is the last text message I got from my friend. And really, what you want is to draw them out into what I call the real world, which, you know, has people walking around in spaces and bumping into each other. Yes, ma'am. My favorite time of year is the summer vacation. It's not just my favorite time of year because I hang out at the beach and stuff like that, because they go away and they come back like different people. Now, I usually think that they mature about this much over the summer, and then by the end of the first quarter, I realize it's really about this much, you know. But what I would say about boys, and this is, if you have kind of a late bloomer kind of guy, a homeschool setting, you can be more flexible, but you're always got to be, you want to be coaxing him. I, you know, as a parent, I always kind of want my kids thinking that I'm trying to pull them forward rather than hold them back. I think it's a lot more rhetorically effective to say, because then they start coming to you when they want to know about the next thing, because, you know, you want to pull them forward. You know, my daughter turns on the stove now, and it messes with our CD collection, because they think they know how to run everything at the house. But I'll buy new CDs. You know, I want her to turn on the stove and to make me a good meal, and her mom's going to be near there and she can watch over, but she's not going to tell her how to do everything. I want them always thinking that I'm pulling them forward. So if you got this late bloomer, always kind of be out there kind of coaxing forward. I think that boys have a tendency sometimes to hold back, and then to move forward in kind of a broader jump. Sometimes that goes along with kind of physical maturity that hits too. So you have this boy that comes back from Christmas, from summer break, and he's this guy. There are a couple of basketball players at my school. I'm waiting for that. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, I want to be honest with you. The whole grade thing, I think is, I think that once we, that, well, listen, we're at year 20 of a 1,000-year experiment. Okay? And we're, the main process that you and I will be involved in for the rest of our lives, however long is it, is mostly about unlearning, not about learning. It's about, Omnibus is a little attempt to kind of break down some of the walls between subject matter areas. I hope that I get to break them all down, you know, I just want to slam everything together and learn. And maybe that's, maybe I'm just kind of out to lunch there. But really, we don't know kind of all the stuff that'll come along. But I would just say, you know, if they get to the end well, be patient with them there in the middle. Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed being here, and thank you.